However, he explains that the problem is the 7th century vocabulary the Quran is forced to use. Once we substitute modern scientific vocabulary, such as uterus for lodging, the problems are more than resolved. As a Muslim who grew up with somewhat fluid interpretations of the Quran, I conceded Busai's point. But as a student of medicine, I realized that no matter how much we substituted the words, one aspect of this verse was simply inaccurate. The verse explains the sequential development of an embryo, but the sequence is incorrect. An embryo does not first become bones to be later clothed with flesh. One layer of an embryo, the mesoderm, differentiates into bone and flesh at the same time. I investigated responses to this critique. Most argued that it's a pedantic objection, but even as a Muslim, I disagreed. The very point Busai was making by referring to this verse is that the sequence of embryonic development is miraculously accurate, but the sequence is incorrect. This was serious, and though Busai treated this verse with some depth, he glossed over the difficulty. That this inaccuracy is found in the clearest section of the verse, the easiest to understand, only compounds the problem. The first part of the verse requires us to substitute appropriate scientific concepts for the incorrect terms captured by the Arabic. So if we have to fix the first half of the statement and ignore the latter half, what is left to be scientifically miraculous? I then realized that this verse could not defend the inspiration of the Quran. Far from it, we had to assume the inspiration of the Quran to defend this verse. More obvious problems arose in the Quran as I continued my search, even in the subfield of human reproduction. Surah 86, verses 6 through 7 state that sperm gushes from between the backbone and the ribs. Believing that it was impossible for the Quran to say something so obviously incorrect, I began looking online for answers. Once again, I found a similar procedure to defend the verse, redefine the words, and gloss over the difficulties. And that was the pattern that emerged. Whether proclaiming scientific miracles or defending scientific inaccuracies, the protocol always called for redefining the clear statements of the Quran to say something that they did not say, and then glossing over any strain. After I recognized the pattern, it struck me that Busaiism was very much like studying the life of Muhammad. I could defend my Islamic beliefs if I approached the issue as a partisan Muslim, willing to redefine certain terms and emphasize certain points in favor of my position. But if I tried to build a case as an objective investigator, reading the text at face value, there simply was no scientifically miraculous knowledge in the Quran. At that point, I did not dismiss the possibility of scientific knowledge in the Quran, but I concluded that something far stronger had to anchor a defense of its divine inspiration. With unrelenting confidence, I now turned to the deepest of all my roots, my faith in the perfect preservation of the Quranic text. Chapter 42, Hadith and the History of the Quran. At least two powerful forces combined to make the perfect textual preservation of the Quran the bastion of Muslim confidence. On the one hand, much like the other proclamations of Islamic pride, it is a ubiquitous axiom that becomes ingrained in the Muslim psyche. At no point has anything in the Quran ever been changed. It comes down to us exactly as Muhammad received it from Gabriel. In this, we are told, is a prophecy of the Quran fulfilled. Surely we have revealed the reminder, and we will most assuredly be its guardian. On the other hand, this belief in perfect textual preservation also forms the very basis for the condemnation of modern Judaism and Christianity. One of the most well-known da'wah initiatives in the United States, called Why Islam, summarizes the sentiment well. The Psalms, the Torah, and the Gospel, according to Islam, are no longer in their original state. They have been added to, cannot be traced directly to their prophets, or were simply altered. Only the Quran has been preserved in its original state, exactly as it was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad. Serving as a basis for the rejection of other faiths and the acceptance of Islam, the preservation of the Quran is critical to Islamic apologetics. But it is even more important to Islamic theology. The Quran is the cornerstone of the Islamic worldview. It underlies all of Sharia, serves as the fulcrum of daily devotions, and provides the source of Islamic identity. In the minds of most Muslims, if the Quran were not perfectly preserved, their world would be in jeopardy. Since that is not the case, they maintain the utmost confidence in their faith. Thus, the preservation of the Quran undergirds the unparalleled confidence of the modern Muslim zeitgeist. It is not even a remote possibility in most Muslims' minds that the Quran of today might be different from the Quran of Muhammad's day. But most Muslims have not read the Hadith for themselves. Once again, it was the most trustworthy Islamic traditions that subverted my faith. Volume 6 of Sahih Bukhari, a volume dedicated to the Quran, details the process of the Quran's collection in Book 61. We find that Muhammad used to dictate the Quran to Muslims orally, not having first written it down. It came to Muslims a few verses at a time, and sometimes Muhammad would relay the same verse differently to different Muslims. Because of this, people recited the Quran disparately enough, even in Muhammad's time, that there were heated, accusatory arguments among pious Muslims over what constituted the real Quran. Since Muhammad was still around, he dispelled the arguments by addressing the parties directly, saying, "Both of you are reciting it in a correct way, so carry on reciting." He admonished them not to argue over their differences, since the nations which were before you were destroyed because they differed. When Muhammad died, many people no longer felt the need to remain Muslim. Abu Bakr sent Muslims to fight the apostates, ordering them to fulfill their Islamic obligations. Muslim fought former Muslim until many who had known the Quran lost their lives in battle. Abu Bakr was worried that large parts of the Quran would be lost if the battles continued, so he officially ordered the Quran to be collected under the auspices of one Zayd ibn Thabit. Sahih Bukhari emphasizes that the Muslims easily forgot Quranic verses, and Zayd found the task of collecting the Quran extremely burdensome. He collected the verses from people's memories and from written fragments. On more than one occasion, only a single person was able to testify to some of the Quran's verses. After Zayd finished, the Quran was ultimately given to one of Muhammad's widows to safeguard. Even though the primary purpose for this collection was that verses not be lost, it was discovered that Zayd had accidentally left a small portion out of the Quran. Moreover, regions of the Muslim world were reciting the Quran incongruously enough that an appeal was made to the Muslim leaders to save this nation before it differs about the Quran. Breaking from the preference of Muhammad, who simply told his people not to focus on the differences, the Khalifa Uthman ordered that the Quran be standardized. They recalled the previous copy from Muhammad's widow, edited it, copied it, and distributed the copies to each Muslim province. Then, to settle the disputes over the Quran once and for all, Uthman ordered that all other Quranic materials, whether written in fragmentary manuscripts or whole copies, be destroyed by fire. This was the story of the Quran's collection as found in Sahih Bukhari. Like the life of Muhammad, Sahih Bukhari depicted a raw, much more realistic story than what Muslims generally teach one another. What I had been taught was that Muhammad would dictate the Quran to scribes while Muslims memorized the revelations, and after Muhammad died, many Muslims had the Quran written and memorized. Zayd ibn Thabit was the first to officially write down the Quran, though this was not a difficult task because he had it memorized. His Quran was confirmed by other leading Muslims who also had the Quran memorized. That was it. According to widely accepted knowledge, there were no arguments over its contents, no poor memories, no fear of lost passages, no solitary witnesses, no forgotten verses, and certainly no orchestrated destruction of variants. The process of collecting the Quran recorded in Sahih Bukhari was so choppy that it left the door wide open for lost sections of the Quran. In fact, Sahih Bukhari testifies to this. When Zayd's standardized Quran was distributed, it left out some sections that a man named Ubay ibn Ka'b used to recite. Ubay insisted that, regardless of Zayd's Quran, he would not stop reciting those verses because he had heard them from Muhammad himself. I was shocked by the testimony of Sahih Bukhari. Why had my teachers not taught me the whole story? What else didn't I know? I turned to other books of Hadith for their story. Sahih Muslim, the next most trustworthy source, records more problems. It documents that a whole surah is no longer found in the Quran, and at least one verse went missing around the time of Muhammad's death. Sunan ibn Majah, one of the next most authentic books, clarifies that the verse went missing because the paper on which it was written was eaten by a goat. As I continued my research, tradition after tradition kept cropping up that challenged the preservation of the Quran. Much like my incredulity when I studied the historical Muhammad, I simply would not assimilate these hadith into my mind, keeping them at bay by accepting the far-fetched explanations of Muslim apologists or by inventing some of my own. What finally pushed me over the edge, though, was when I revisited a hadith from Sahih Bukhari. According to the hadith, Muhammad named four men as the best teachers of the Quran. The first was Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, whom Muhammad distinguished as the foremost expert of the Quran. The last one was Ubay ibn Ka'b, whom Sahih Bukhari identifies as the best reciter of the Quran. These were the men that Muhammad hand-selected as the best teachers of the Quran. But as I studied the early sources, I found that they did not agree with the final Quran, which has been passed down as today's version. They didn't even agree with each other. In addition to the previously quoted hadith in which he refused to stop reciting certain verses, Ubay is known to have had 116 chapters in his Quran, two more than Zayd's edition. Ibn Mas'ud had only 111 chapters in his Quran, insisting that the additional chapters in Zayd's Quran and Ubay's Quran were just prayers, not Quranic recitation. Multiple early Muslims documented the differences between the many Qurans of the early Muslim world. Though it was thought that all of those documents were destroyed, one resurfaced in the early 20th century. It shows that, in many places, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud and Ubay ibn Ka'b agreed with one another, where Zayd ibn Thabit's Quran differed. I added up all the pieces in my mind. Multiple recitations of the same verse, missing verses, missing surahs, disputes over the canon, controlled destruction of all variants. How could we defend the Quran as perfectly preserved? I researched defenses online and read the most scholarly Islamic books I could find. As usual, attempts were made to dismiss as many of the sources as possible. Even still, after attempts at logical explanation were made, the Muslim scholars argued for a shocking position. Allah intended the lost sections to be lost. He intended the variants to be destroyed, and he intended Zayd's edition to be the final Quran. So in truth, the scholars were not arguing that the Quran had remained unchanged. They were arguing that Allah intended all the many changes that came to it. That was a defensive position at best, not one that could bear the weight of the entire Islamic case. I was forced to conclude that, once again, the early Islamic sources challenged what modern Islam taught me. The doctrine of the Quran's perfect preservation, far from defending the faith, needed to be defended by faith. With that final investigation, the keystone of my faith crumbled. The entire structure was ungrounded, poised to collapse at the slightest burden. What came next might as well have been dynamite. Chapter 43, Those Whom Their Right Hands Possess. I had read the words multiple times since childhood, never really stopping to consider what they meant. But David had just added it to his binder, and now I was forced to research it. Those whom your right hands possess was a phrase found in multiple Quran verses. The three references David included were Surah 4, verse 24, Surah 23, verse 6, in Surah 70, verse 30, none of which made much sense at first blush. Surah 4, verse 24. Forbidden for you are women already married, except such as your right hands possess. Allah has enjoined this on you. Surah 23, verse 6. Successful indeed are those believers who guard their private parts, except from their wives or those whom their right hands possess. Surah 70, verse 30. Worshippers guard their private parts, except from their wives and from those whom their right hands possess. Such, indeed, are not to blame. I took the verses to Ummi and asked her what the phrase meant. She said it referred to the female servants that Muslim men had married. But it didn't fit. In the verses, wives were clearly separate from those whom the right hands possessed. When I pushed back on her interpretation, she deferred to scholars in the Jamaat. I left Ummi, agreeing to ask them when the next opportunity would arise. In the meantime, I knew I had to research this on my own. The scholars had not been comprehensive before, and I had no reason to think they would be now. Of course, David had given me his interpretation, but I knew it was wrong. It had to be wrong. He was arguing that those whom the right hands possessed were slave women captured by Muslim conquerors. According to him, Surah 23 verse 6 and Surah 70 verse 30 meant Muslim men could have intercourse with slave women that had been captured as spoils of war. Not stopping there, he argued that Surah 4 verse 24 annulled the marriages of captive women so Muslims could have intercourse with them even if their husbands were still alive. The mere suggestion was outrageous. He was implying that the Quran condoned rape. What else would it be? If a woman is captured in battle, her father, husband, brother, or son probably just died to protect her. Would such a woman willingly engage in intercourse with the warrior who had just slaughtered the men she loved? This was not the Islam I knew, astaghfirullah. My Muhammad was a liberator of slaves and a commander of saints, not a conquering captor leading an army of rapists. Islam would not allow such an atrocity. It could not. Even though I had learned much over the previous few months that challenged everything I knew, this was in a different league entirely. David was accusing Muhammad of being a moral monster, insinuating that Islam was unconscionably cruel. During the course of our conversations, I lashed out at David, rebuking him for trying to drag my prophet through the mud. This was lower than low. At first, he fought back, pointing to the Islamic traditions. But when he saw that each defense he provided galled me all the more, he pulled back. He left the issue alone, asking me to just consider why I was so offended and what the Quran was really teaching. It was when I was alone, when I did not have to defend my faith or my prophet, that I was able to be honest with myself and look at the evidence anew. Sahih Muslim gave the historical context for the revelation of Surah 4, verse 24. The hadith reads, "At the Battle of Hunain, Allah's messenger sent an army to Autas and fought with the enemy. Having overcome them and taken them captives, the companions of Allah's messenger seemed to refrain from having intercourse with captive women because of their polytheist husbands. Then Allah Most High sent down the verse, 'Forbidden for you are women already married, except those whom your right hands possess.'" Surah 4 verse 24. I read and reread the hadith. There was no question that this hadith corroborated David's argument. In fact, it appeared David had been gentle. The hadith says this verse not only allowed warriors to have intercourse with recently captured women, it emboldened the men to do so when they were hesitant. I could not believe what I was reading. My world felt as if it was spinning beneath my feet. I immediately did what I had seen sheikhs and imams do. I concluded the hadith must be weak. A single hadith, even in Sahih Muslim, is easy to dismiss. But there it was again in Sunan Abu Dawud, which actually provided even more detail. The Muslim warriors were hesitant to have sex with the women because their husbands were still alive and in their presence. One classical commentary explained that when Surah 4 verse 24 was revealed, the men proceeded to have sex with the women despite their husbands' presence. Sahih Bukhari contains a similar hadith. It also describes Muslim warriors who were hesitant to sexually engage their captive women, but for a different reason. The warriors were worried about getting the women pregnant. Muhammad allayed their concerns, telling them that it was Allah's choice whether the women got pregnant or not. Sahih Muslim adds to this hadith, saying that the Muslim warriors did not want to get the women pregnant because they planned on selling them. That was enough. Not only was David right about the meaning of those whom their right hands possess, but the truth was inescapable. It was in the Quran, it was in Sahih Bukhari, in Sahih Muslim, in Sunan Abu Dawud, in commentaries. It was everywhere. How could it be possible? The Quran allowed men to have intercourse with women whose lives had just been destroyed, sometimes in the presence of their captive husbands? Allah and Muhammad both showed no concern for getting the women pregnant or later selling them into slavery? How could it be possible? What if it were my people who had been conquered by Muslims? What if I fought to protect my family, only to see Abba killed, to see Baji and Ummi? No, that was more than enough. I was done. I could not think about it any longer. It was revolting, and thinking about it would only cause me to despise my prophet and my faith. I would not allow myself to despise them. but I could find no way to excuse them either. So I was done. I was done fighting. I was finally broken. Part 9. Faith in Doubt. I don't know who you are anymore, but I know that you are all that matters. Chapter 44. Rationality and Revelation. For 3 years, we had wrestled with one another intellectually, and what started in the first month of my freshman year finally came to a head the day before graduation. I was giving up. But not on Islam. Not yet. I was giving up on reason. We sat in the front seats of my car, having just returned from an award ceremony. Out of a graduating class of thousands, 6 students were selected to receive ODU's highest recognition, Kauffman Honors, based on grades, leadership, and community service. David and I were 2 of the 6. The award signified the culmination of my college career. But it sat heedlessly tossed in the back seat. I didn't care about it. I couldn't get myself to care about much of anything. I had lived my whole life with a vibrant confidence. Islam, my beliefs, my family, my words, and my actions all converged into one point, me. I had been authentic and transparent, able to speak my mind and live my beliefs freely and fully. But now? Now I was a shell, outwardly steadfast in Islam while inwardly a torrent of confusion. The honor-shame paradigm hindered me from sharing my inner turmoil, rendering me unable to speak to friends or family about my struggle without further destabilizing my life. I did not know who God was, I did not know what the world was, I did not know who I was, and I had no idea what to do. I was in a maelstrom, flailing for something to hold on to. I made a final, desperate effort to lay hold of the life I had always lived. "There's no way I can accept the Christian message, David." I kept my eyes glued to the steering wheel while David stared at nothing in particular through the passenger window. He gave me space to speak. "The Christian God demands that I proclaim a fact," I continued. "He demands that I believe Jesus is Lord. But I wasn't there. I can't know whether he claimed to be God. I'm Muslim. I've always seen the world as a Muslim. My perception is colored in such a way that, even if Jesus were God, I probably wouldn't be able to know it. How can God hold me eternally accountable for not grasping a finite fact, one which I have no access to in the first place?" This was my last-ditch effort to maintain my Islamic faith, denying my ability to arrive at objective truth. David continued staring into the distance, considering my words carefully. When he finally spoke, his words cut to the quick. "Nabil, you know that's not true. Your parents see dreams, and God has directed you with supernatural signs in the sky. You know full well that if you ask him to reveal the truth to you, he will." As soon as David spoke, I knew he was right. It was as if his words resonated a raw nerve, one that had only just been aired. If I truly believed God existed, why did I not simply ask him who he is? Could he not reveal that truth to me? It was then that I realized the value of apologetics and what the arguments had done for me. All my life, barriers had been erected that kept me from humbly approaching God and asking him to reveal himself to me. The arguments and apologetics tore down those barriers, positioning me to make a decision to pursue God, or not. The work of my intellect was done. It had opened the way to his altar, but I had to decide whether I would approach it. If I did, and if I really wanted to know God, I had to cast myself upon his mercy and love, relying completely upon him and his willingness to reveal himself to me. But at what cost? Chapter 45. The Cost of Embracing the Cross. The cost for a Muslim to accept the gospel can be tremendous. Of course, following Jesus meant that I would immediately be ostracized from my community. For all devout Muslims, it means sacrificing the friendships and social connections that they have built from childhood. It could mean being rejected by one's parents, siblings, spouse, and children. This becomes exponentially more difficult if the Muslim has no person to turn to after following Jesus, no Christian who has reached out. I know of many Muslim women who recognize their need for Jesus, but but have nowhere to turn if their husbands abandon them, or worse. They often do not have the financial means to survive the next day, let alone fight for their children in court. They would have to do all this while reeling from an emotionally violent expulsion from their extended families. What many do not realize, what I did not realize when I was making these decisions, is that these costs are not considered consciously. They form part of the knee-jerk reaction against the gospel. I never said, I choose to remain Muslim because it would cost me my family if I were to follow Jesus. Far from it. I subconsciously found ways and means to go on rejecting the gospel so I would not be faced with what I would have to pay. But I was not the only one who would have to pay for my decision. If there were traits my family was known for in the Muslim community, they were my parents' joyfulness, our close-knit relationships, and the honor we had garnered by faithfully following Islam. My choice to follow Jesus meant raising all three. My decision would shame my family with incredible dishonor. Even if I were right about Jesus, could I do such a terrible thing to my family, after everything they had done for me? It is this kind of familial dishonor that drives many in the Middle East to commit honor killings. Although there is no command in the Quran or Hadith to carry out honor killings, there are commands in the Quran to kill mischief makers, as well as plenty of commands in the Hadith to kill apostates. These kinds of killings are not limited to the Middle East. A few months after graduation, I received a phone call from Mike telling me about an entire family of Middle Eastern Christians who had just been slaughtered in New Jersey for bringing dishonor to Islam. He asked me if I thought I'd be safe were I to accept Jesus. I appreciated his concern, but I told him that that was the least of my worries. My family would never do such a thing, and in reality, the killings are not as common as some fear. Besides, in my view, martyrdom would be an honor. The greatest concern for me, were I to accept Jesus as Lord, was that I might be wrong. What if Jesus is not God? I'd be worshiping a human. That would incur the wrath of Allah, and more than anything else, it would secure my abode in hell. Of course, that is exactly what the Quran teaches. In Islam, there is only one unforgivable sin, shirk, the belief that someone other than Allah is God. Shirk is specifically discussed in the context of Jesus, in Surah 5, verse 72. He who believes Jesus is God, Allah has forbidden heaven for him, and his abode will be the hellfire. These are the costs Muslims must calculate when considering the gospel. Losing the relationships they have built in this life, potentially losing this life itself, and if they are wrong, losing their afterlife in paradise. It is no understatement to say that Muslims often risk everything to embrace the cross. But then again, it is the cross. There is a reason Jesus said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it." Mark chapter 8, verses 34 through 35. Would it be worth it to pick up my cross and be crucified next to Jesus? If he is not God, then no. Lose everything I love to worship a false god a million times over, no. But if he is God, then yes. Being forever bonded to my Lord by suffering alongside him? A million times over, yes. Now more than ever, the stakes were clear, and I needed to know who he was. Everything hinged on his identity. I began begging him to reveal himself. Standing, walking, praying, lying in bed, I implored him to show me his truth. Because he had supernaturally guided me before, I had full faith that he would guide me once again. But the interim was agonizing. I traveled from mosque to mosque, asking imams and scholars to help me with my struggles. None came close to vindicating either Muhammad or the Quran, all of them selectively denying traditions that were problematic and cherry-picking traditions that fit their views. They did not help. While waiting to speak with them, I read book after book from Muslim scholars on Hadith methodology, Sira, and Quranic history until my eyes were scorched. Then my eyes would flood with tears during Salat, while I pleaded with God for his mercy. Chapter 46. I am near. Seek, and you shall find. I lay prostrate in a large Muslim prayer hall, broken before God. The edifice of my worldview, all I had ever known, had slowly been dismantled over the past few years. I lay in ruin, petitioning Allah. Tears blurred my sight. The ritual prayers had ended, and now it was time for my heart's prayer. Please, God Almighty, tell me who you are. I beseech you and only you. Only you can rescue me. At your feet I lay down everything I have learned, and I give my entire life to you. Take away what you will, be it my joy, my friends, my family, or even my life. But let me have you, O God. Light the path that I must walk. I don't care how many hurdles are in the way, how many pits I must jump over or climb out of, or how many thorns I must step through. Guide me on the right path. If it is Islam, show me how it is true. If it is Christianity, give me eyes to see. Just show me which path is yours, dear God, so I can walk it. Dear God, I know that you can hear me. I know you are there and my words are not falling on deaf ears. Do not withhold yourself from me. You have guided me with visions before. You have revealed the future to my father in dreams. Please, show me your truth. Give me a vision again. Give me dreams so I can know who you are. I knew with utmost surety that God heard my cries and held the key to saving me. He would open the door to his truth at any moment. I knew that the case for Christianity was strong. It had been shown to me that the historical Jesus claimed to be God and then proved it by dying on the cross and rising from the dead. If Allah confirmed to me personally that he was actually the God of the Bible, I would accept him, Jesus, as my Lord. In anguish, though, I hoped beyond hope that Allah would reveal himself to be the God of Islam. The cost would be too much to bear otherwise. Every day, in every prayer, I clung to two verses. Surah 2, verse 186. When my servants ask about me, I am near. I answer their prayers when they pray to me. So let them hear my call and believe in me, that they may walk in the right way. Matthew chapter 7, verses 7 through 8. Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. The one who seeks finds. And to the one who knocks, the door will be opened. Because of these verses, I had full faith that God, whether Allah or Jesus, whether the God of the Quran or the God of the Bible, would answer the prayers of my heart. The question was when, and whether I could brave the storm until then. 5 months later, he gave me my answer. Chapter 47, A Field of Crosses. On December 19th, 2004, Abba and I were in Orlando, Florida. I had just finished my first semester of medical school, having once again chosen the school closest to home so I could be with my family. Ummi and Abba saw me diligently studying the whole semester and wanted to reward me. So when Abba needed to go to Florida for a conference during my winter break, he invited me to come with him. I gladly obliged, not only because it was my first opportunity to go to Florida, but also because it would be the first time Abba and I would go on a trip by ourselves. We had a fantastic time traveling to Orlando, cracking jokes and sharing stories. I recounted our antics in the anatomy lab, and he shared humorous accounts of his early years in the Navy when he worked as a medic. Except for in the airport security line, when we were under the post-9/11 microscope, we goofed off the whole way to Florida. We were forging a new aspect of our relationship, a father-son friendship. That night in the hotel room, after Abba and I prayed the Isha Salat together, we discussed our plans for the next morning while getting into our beds. Bilu, you can sleep late tomorrow and then relax in the hotel. I have to go to a meeting first thing in the morning. When I finish in the afternoon, we'll go to Epcot together. I've got an idea, Abba. How about I drop you off so I can have the rental car? That way I can go to Epcot when it opens and then you can join me there. Okay, but you'll need to get up first thing in the morning to drop me off. That's not a problem, Abba. Chalo, beta, recite. Allahumma bi ismika amuto wa ahya. This was the nightly prayer that Abba had me recite whenever he tucked me in from the time I was 3 years old. Kids will always be kids to their parents. I recited it and kissed him on the cheek. I love you, Abba. Of course you do. You're my son. That was Abba's way of saying, I love you too. With that, he turned off the lights. It was dark in the room, but enough light poured in from around the curtains that I could make out the objects in the room. The day had been filled with laughter and joy, but my mind and my heart were in a constant underlying state of perturbation. When the lights went off in Florida, just like every night in Virginia, my mind was immediately flooded with a longing for the truth about God. As soon as I was sure Abba was fast asleep, I got out from under the comforters and crept to the edge of my bed. The precariousness of my fate manifested itself in my mind. Tearfully, I contended with God, pleading once again that he would reveal himself. I admitted that, despite all I thought I knew, I actually knew nothing. I needed God to show me the truth. I couldn't do it without his help, and I couldn't take the uncertainty much longer. It was quite probably the most humble moment of my life, and I begged him desperately for a dream or a vision. At that instant, the room went pitch dark. I looked out into the blackness before me. Where there had been a wall just a few feet from my bed, the wall was no longer. What I saw instead was a field with hundreds of crosses. They were glowing in bright contrast to the darkness around them. The tears ceased. My body was paralyzed, and time stood still. I panned over the crosses, but they were beyond number. And just as quickly as it had come, the vision was gone. I was back in the hotel room at the edge of my bed. In stunned silence, I considered what I had just seen. After a few moments, I looked up towards the heavens and said, God, that doesn't count. One side of my mind was asking, did God just reveal himself to me? Did he finally answer my prayers? I saw a field of crosses. That must mean he wants me to accept the gospel. But the other side played devil's advocate, arguing, Nabil, if you're wrong about this, Allah will send you to hell forever. This could be Satan trying to confuse you because you've been flirting with shirk, the polytheism of Christianity. And, somewhere in my mind, the more rationalist side of me thought, maybe you're just jet-lagged and seeing things. Do you really want to make the biggest decision of your life based on one sleepy, emotional moment? Are you ready to give up everything for this? I turned toward Abba, who was softly snoring on his side of the room. I finally concluded to myself, no, I can't give him up. Just based on this. God will understand. I need more. I returned to God, shamed but emboldened. I prayed, God, that doesn't count. I don't know if that was really what I thought it was. I could subconsciously want to become a Christian, and my mind could be deceiving me. So, I'm sorry I asked for a vision. Please give me a dream. And if the dream confirms the vision, I will become Christian. Perhaps I was subconsciously trying to stall the inevitable, but God would not allow it. He gave me a dream that very night. Part 10. Guided by the Hand of God. Give me eyes to see. Just show me which path is yours, dear God, so I can walk it. Chapter 48. Deciphering Dreams. It was still dark when I dropped Abba off at his meeting. There was some time before Epcot opened, so I decided to go back to the hotel and sleep. A few hours later, my eyes shot open, heart pounding. God had given me a dream, and I had no idea what it meant. The quality of this dream was unlike any I had ever experienced. Even while in the dream, I had an awareness that this was a message from God. I don't know how, I just knew. But the dream was cryptic, full of symbols I did not understand. After waking, I remembered the dream with crystal clarity, and none of the vague fuzziness that accompanies my other dreams. Though it was emblazoned on my mind, I did not know how long I would remember it, so I wrote everything down, my mind still reeling from this apparent revelation. This is what I wrote that day. In the beginning of the dream, there was a poisonous snake with red and black bands going around it, separated by thin white stripes. All it did was hiss at people when they stepped into the garden. The people in the garden couldn't see it. It was far away and watching from a perch on a stone pillar. This pillar was across a chasm. The perch then became my vantage point for the first half of the dream. In a garden-like area with hills and lush green grass and trees, there was a huge iguana, like a dragon. It would lie still and hide by becoming like a hill. No one who walked on it knew it was an iguana. If they had known, they would be scared. But the iguana liked the fact that no one knew. Then a giant boy came, and this giant boy knew that the iguana was an iguana. And he stepped on it, accusing it of being an iguana. The iguana got angry, so he reared back to bite the giant boy, who had stepped on its tail. As the iguana was about to bite the boy had a huge cricket that challenged the iguana to a fight. My vantage point changes now, and I am directly beneath the iguana, looking up at its head. The iguana nodded and accepted the challenge, and as the cricket flew away to go to a fighting place, the iguana turned to me and tried to lunge at me and kill me. The cricket saw that the iguana was lunging at me, so he came back and bit its head off, decapitating it. All morning, my thoughts were consumed with this dream. What did it mean? What were the symbols, and how did they fit together? I immediately tried fitting the pieces together. The snake on the stone pillar had to symbolize evil. What else could it be? The garden was the world. That I started seeing the world from the snake's perspective means I must have had some hidden evil inside me from the beginning of my world. This strikes me as a Christian concept, original sin. Or perhaps it means that Islam, which was in me from the very beginning, is evil. I'm not sure, but both seem to point to Christianity. As I looked into the world, what seemed to be a natural part of the landscape was actually another reptile, reminiscent of the snake, but so massive that people were walking on it thinking it was a hill. Then a boy came along and challenged it, calling it out for what it actually was. In tandem, these symbols could only fit one explanation. The boy was David, calling out the iguana, Islam, as a falsehood. The iguana, Islam, was naturally deceptive and tricked people into thinking that it was a natural part of the world. The boy's cricket had to be Christianity, which challenged the iguana. That the cricket could speak and the iguana could not means that Christianity is able to speak for itself, or in other words, it has a strong case. That the iguana could not speak means it is unable to provide proof for itself. This is confirmed when the cricket challenged the iguana, but the iguana tried to kill me instead of rising to the challenge. When the iguana tried to kill me, the cricket saved me. This strikes me as salvation, which comes from no merit of my own. Another Christian concept. I turned the dream over and over in my head, trying to find meanings that would fit better, but this was the best I could come up with. But it was pro-Christian, so I did not have much confidence in my interpretation. I began to think about ways to get the dream interpreted without revealing my internal struggles. I decided to survey people for advice. I called David just as I walked into Epcot and saw the iconic sphere, Spaceship Earth. Nabil, the real deal! What's up? How's Florida? This was not a moment for small talk. Not bad. I'm having fun. Hey, I've got a question for you. Do Christians get dreams from God? David didn't miss a beat. Why, what'd you see? I didn't say I saw anything. Answer the question. David thought for a moment before answering. The Bible is full of stories where people get dreams from God. Joseph, for example. Joseph the prophet or Joseph the father of Jesus? He chuckled. Both, actually. In the New Testament, Joseph the father of Jesus gets like 5 dreams which are clear instructions from God. But I was referring to the Old Testament Joseph, who was able to interpret really symbolic dreams. That's how God rescued him from prison. The Bible talked about interpreting symbolic dreams? This was exactly what I was seeking. So, how did Joseph interpret the dreams? How do Christians interpret dreams today? He had a gift of interpretation from God. I don't know of any Christians who interpret dreams today, but I don't doubt that if God gave someone a dream that needed to be interpreted, Then he would also provide the means to interpret it. His words triggered a memory in the recesses of my mind. Ummi sometimes referred to a dream interpretation book written by ancient dream interpreter Ibn Sirin. Maybe God would guide me through it. Anxious to call Ummi, I hurried to get off the phone with David. All right, thanks, man. I'll catch you later. Yo, you going to tell me the dream you saw or what? I didn't say anything about seeing a dream. I didn't say you said anything, but are you going to tell me? Yeah, I'll tell you, but let me sit on it for now. I got off the phone with David and immediately called Ummi. This was going to be tricky. I wanted to share the symbols in my dream without telling her the whole story. Hello? Assalamu alaikum, Ummi. Wa alaikum salam. Are you with Abba? I'm at Epcot. Abba will be meeting me here after work. I can't talk much right now. I want to make the most of my time at the park. But I had a dream last night. Do you have Ibn Sirin's book nearby? It's upstairs. What was your dream? Ummi's tone took on a note of concern, which I found exasperating. How was it that everyone could see right through me? Ummi, it was long and complicated. Nothing to worry about. I'll share the details with you when I get home. I just want to know what the symbols mean so I can think about it for now. It doesn't work like that, Billu. You have to share the whole thing for me to interpret it. But Ummi, can't you just read me what the book says? I want to interpret it for myself. Berta, the book says a lot. The symbols depend on their context. Tell me the first symbol. A snake. Astaghfirullah, she gasped. What kind of dream is this? Ummi. Okay, fine. Was the snake in the water? Was it sleeping? Was it eating? What did it do? Why does that matter? The book says different things. Just a snake means a deceptive or avowed enemy. But if the snake eats someone, or if someone turns into a snake, then it can mean something else. Her last words caught my attention. Shortly after the snake was introduced into my dream, I started seeing from its vantage point. Was that me turning into the snake? I probed the matter as discreetly as I could. Well, it can't be all that different from enemy, right? Like, what does it mean if someone turns into a snake? Ummi answered, It means that person is questioning his religion. My heart froze. Did she just say what I thought she said? I probed some more. Well, the snake was on a pillar. What does that mean? Looking it up, she read, A pillar is the symbol for someone's religion. This was getting to be too much. Was she reading my mind? She continued, Do you remember what that pillar was made out of? Stone. She paused for a moment. This is strange. Not what I would have expected. The book says that a stone pillar means someone's religion, or the way they see the world, is changing very quickly. I could not believe what I was hearing. It was as if every symbol spoke exactly to my situation. I was quickly becoming certain that God intended me to interpret the symbols based on this book. Okay, Ummi, that's good enough. What about an iguana? What's that? It's a big lizard. After flipping through some pages and clarifying the symbol, Ummi found this, under monitor lizard. It means a cruel, hidden enemy who appears very great and fearsome, but if it is challenged, it will fail because of inability to provide proof. I was stunned. Could it really say all that? Those were my exact concerns about Islam, which is how I understood the symbol. Plus, in the dream, the iguana started off hiding through deception, ultimately unable to speak for itself. What about a boy? What kind of boy? A newborn? A little boy? A teenager? A little boy, I said hurriedly. I was eager to piece together what God was telling me. Little boy by age, but not size. A young boy in a dream is a friend who will help you overcome your enemies. He is the bearer of good news. Good news? That's exactly what the word gospel means. David was my friend who came bearing the gospel. In overcoming my enemies, in the dream, the boy helped me overcome the lizard. My head began reeling. Wait, Ummi added, was the boy beautiful? Yes, actually, he was quite handsome. Then not only will this friend help you overcome your enemies, he will provide you with something you are seeking, something that will give you an abundant life. By this point, I could hardly speak. Last one, Ummi. Cricket. A cricket bat or a cricket ball? No, not the game. A cricket like a grasshopper. Like iguana, the symbol was not in the book, but she found something related under locust. A locust is a warrior. Once again, the interpretation fit the dream perfectly. Did it cause you harm? No, it caused my enemy harm. If it did not cause you harm, then it means a warrior will bring you joy and happiness. Oh, and here again it says it will help you overcome your enemies. Berta, I don't know the dream you had, but the symbols are related. I think this dream was from Allah. Achami, I've written it down. You can tell me your interpretation when I come home. I have to go on me before the park gets busy. Okay, have fun, Berta. Call me when Abba gets there. Acha. Or call me if he's taking too long. Acha. You know what? Just call me. Acha, me, I will. I love you, Khuda Hafiz. When I hung up the phone, I could hardly believe what had just happened. Every single symbol fit perfectly, all pointing to the interpretation I had come up with shortly after seeing the dream. And far from barely fitting, they fit almost too well. But the devil's advocate started whispering. I began focusing on the two symbols that did not fit with perfection. It was not a monitor lizard. It was an iguana. It was not a locust. It was a cricket. Why would every other symbol have fit perfectly when these only came close? I began turning the words over in my mind. Cricket. Iguana. Cricket. Iguana. Cur. Eh. Christianity. Islam. No. No, it was too much. It was all too much. I needed some time to sit on this. Chapter 49. The Narrow Door. I sat on the dream for another 2 months. Each day, the devil's advocate in my mind growing louder and louder. Could I really hinge my life and eternal destiny on a dream? Just one dream, and that dream so symbolic that I needed Ibn Sirin or Joseph to interpret it for me. Perhaps I interpreted the dream in favor of Christianity because, subconsciously, I wanted Christianity to be true? Or perhaps I wanted Islam to subconsciously be true, so Shaitan was trying his best to trick me into damnation. Like the vision in the hotel room, the dream was just so ambiguous that I could imagine explaining it in a variety of ways. In fact, that's what happened. I shared the dream with Ummi, who told me she did not know exactly how all the symbols fit together, but it was a sign from Allah that ought to confirm my confidence in Islam. When I shared the vision and dream with David, he said that there was no doubt that the dream pointed me to Christianity. All these thoughts mixed in my head, and I did not dare ask God for another dream or vision. In my heart, I knew he had given me one of each, but I was too broken to be sure what they meant. The opposing forces, the uncertainty, and the potential costs almost paralyzed me. Almost. I remember what David had said about Joseph in the New Testament. God had given him clear instructions through dreams. That was what I needed, and surely if God wanted to guide me, a broken skeptic, he would know that I needed more. 3, I said to myself, Allah likes odd numbers, and the Christian God is triune. Why not ask for 3 dreams? So I returned to Allah in prayer, with a very specific request. Instead of just one dream, please give me 3. If they all point to Christianity, then I will become a Christian. Please, Lord, show me mercy. Please make the next dream so easy to understand that it requires no interpretation. On the morning of March 11th, 2005, I had a new dream to scrawl onto paper. I am standing at the entrance of a narrow doorway that is built into a wall of brick. I am not in the doorway, but just in front of it. The doorway is an arch. I would say the doorway is about 7.5 feet tall, with about 6.5 feet of its sides being straight up from the ground. And there's a 1-foot arched part on the top, capping it off. The doorway is slightly less than 3 feet wide, and about 3 or 4 feet deep, all brick. It leads into a room, where many people are sitting at tables that have fancy and good food on them. I think I remember salads, but I'm not sure. They weren't eating, but they were all ready to eat, and they were all looking to my left, as if waiting for a speaker before the banquet. One of the people at the other side of the door, just inside of the room, is David Wood. I am unable to walk into the room because David is occupying the other threshold of the doorway. He is sitting at a table and is also looking to my left. I asked him, I thought we were going to eat together. And he said, without removing his eyes from the front of the room, you never responded. When I woke up from the dream, I immediately had an interpretation. The room was heaven. The feast was a feast in the kingdom of heaven, and it was a wedding feast of sorts. In order to get into the room, I had to respond to David's invitation. If there was one thing I did not get about the dream, it was the door. It was the most dramatic symbol in the dream. But what did it mean? Why was that the most vivid image? And why was it so narrow? By this time, Ummi was becoming suspicious of my questions about dreams, and since this one had David in it, there was no way I could ask her what she thought it meant. I called David, though, to see what he thought. Nabil, he responded, this dream is so clear, it doesn't need to be interpreted. His words immediately reminded me of what I had prayed to God a few days earlier. Asking for more, he told me to read Luke chapter 13, verse 22. Instead of Abba's King James Version, I turned to a study Bible that David had given me the previous year as a gift. I had never even opened it until this point. It was a Zondervan NIV study Bible. When I arrived at the passage, in big bold letters, the section heading read, The Narrow Door. My heart skipped a beat. I had never seen this section of the Bible before. I carefully read it and reread it. Then Jesus went through the towns and villages, teaching as he made his way to Jerusalem. Someone asked him, Lord, are only a few people going to be saved? He said to them, Make every effort to enter through the narrow door, because many, I tell you, will try to enter and will not be able to. Once the owner of the house gets up and closes the door, you will stand outside, knocking and pleading, Sir, open the door for us. There will be weeping there and gnashing of teeth, when you see Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and all the prophets in the kingdom of God, but you yourselves thrown out. People will come from east and west, and north and south, and will take their places at the feast in the kingdom of God. I stopped reading and put the Bible down. I was overwhelmed. God had given me a dream that was so clear that I did not need to interpret it. The interpretation had been recorded in the Bible for 2,000 years. The narrow door was the door to salvation. Jesus was telling me to make every effort to enter into it, and I knew from the dream that I needed to respond to David's invitation in order to enter and take my place in the feast of the kingdom of heaven. If I did not enter, I would be left standing outside, asking to come in. That is where I stood, just outside the narrow door of salvation, wondering why I had not been let in. Thankfully, the owner had not yet come to close the door. There was now no question left. I knew what I had to do. I had to accept the invitation. Chapter 50. A Stairway Out of the Mosque. I had asked for 3 dreams, though, and God is unbelievably gracious. In the early hours of April 24th, 2005, I received a 3rd dream. I am sitting on the first step of a flight of white stairs in a masjid. The stairs go up, and they have ornate posts at the first step, with hand railings going up to the left. I am not sure of the material of the stairs, though I'm thinking either stone or marble or wood. I am facing away from the top of the stairs. I can see myself in this dream, and the angle of view is of my right side as I sit on the stairs and look forward, where I'm expecting someone to speak, possibly at a brown wooden podium, though I'm not sure. The room has green carpeting, and people are expected to sit on the floor, though I am on the first stair and feel nothing wrong with this. I expect people to fill in the section to my left, which is also to the left of the stairs. Nothing is going on in the right side of the room. As the room gradually fills up, the imam sits down on the floor, slightly behind me and to my left. He is wearing white and is looking in the same direction as everyone else. Since I expected him to be the speaker, and since he is a holy man and the imam, I am surprised and confused that he is on the floor behind me. Out of respect, I try to get off the stairs and sit behind him, but I'm unable.